13. Once the shock of taking flight and of holding hands with another grown man had subsided, Martin really enjoyed flying. It was much smoother than his rudimentary hover program. They zoomed over the rooftops until they reached the edge of town. Now they were gliding along over the forest about 20 feet over the treetops. Martin was trailing along behind Philip in a posture that suggested he was hanging by one hand, but in truth he didn't feel his weight at all. Gentle wind resistance had pushed him back, but his grip was in no danger of failing. Philip was holding on to Martin with his left hand. His right was extended before them, holding his staff at the midpoint and extending its two halves to their sides like wings. Martin watched. It became clear that Philip was steering by tilting the staff.
Is this as fast as we can go?
We can go much faster, but if you get above 35 miles an hour, the wind becomes unpleasant. Besides, we aren't going far.
The rest of the trip was spent in silence. Before he agreed to training, Martin had seen a brief sample of what Philip could do, and of course, he was keen to avoid going back to his time to deal with the small army of federal agents converging on his parents' house. But this was the first thing he'd seen that made him actively want the training. He wondered how long it would be before he learned to fly, and what other things he would learn. The trees ended and a patchwork of small farms spread out before them. They veered to the left, lost some altitude, then came to a gentle landing next to a run-down stone hut with a shaggy-looking thatched roof.
Ah, all right, Philip said, straightening his robe. Don't say a word. Just follow my lead and do as I say. This won't take long.
Philip knocked on the door. From inside, there was the sound of yelling, a cat hissing, and objects falling. Slowly, the sounds got louder. Finally, the door opened, revealing an old woman. She was small and thin-boned, but she didn't look fragile. She seemed to be made of twisted wire and beef jerky. Her dress was the color of mud, and she was barefoot. A cat was perched on her shoulder, deploying every claw it had to stay there, hissing non-stop.
Hello, Miss Abigail. How does this day find you?
Philip asked slowly and loudly, smiling like a used car salesman. Her reply was loud and made up mostly of vowel sounds.
I see,
Philip said.
I'm told that you have need of my services again.
She nodded and emitted more vowel sounds, punctuated with a few sprays of saliva. The cat hissed its agreement.
Your goat again, I assume?
This time the vowels were yelled at greater volume, and the saliva was launched with more force. She gestured wildly, flailing her arms, while the hissing cat tried desperately to keep its perch.
Of course, I'll be happy to help. I'll let you know when it's done,
Philip said. She nodded. The cat hissed, and the old woman shut the door. Philip turned back to Martin.
There, the worst is over. Follow me.
Philip walked around to the back of the house. There were two patches of ground surrounded by rough wood fences. A gate connected the two fenced areas. The gate was open. In one pen, there was a goat, standing still, staring at Philip and Martin.
What now?
Martin asked.
Now we move the goat from one pen to the other. Usually the goat moves to the other pen on its own, but every now and then it refuses and Miss Abigail sends one of her neighbors into town to get me. I got word yesterday that I was needed, so here we are.
Martin shook his head.
So when you said we were going to contain an ancient evil, you meant we were going to put a goat in a pen?
No, I meant we were going to do what Miss Abigail wants so she won't come into town herself to get me.
How will the townsfolk react if they find out that Miss Abigail is the ancient evil?
They know, Miss Abigail. I expect they'll thank me. Now, on to business. Marty, how would you go about moving that goat?
Well, we could go in there and shove it. Could be that just trying would scare it so that it flees into the other pen.
Yes, but I suspect Miss Abigail tried that. No, she sent for a wizard, so we have to be sure to move the goat the way you'd expect a wizard would.
Philip held his staff with one hand and pointed at the goat with the other. In a deep, booming voice, he said,
Levi obiecto!
Slowly he raised his hand, and the goat lifted into the air, staying in perfect alignment with his hand. Philip moved his arm smoothly, changing his aim from the airspace above one pen to the airspace above the other, and the goat moved through the air. It would have been almost majestic if the goat weren't flailing its legs wildly and bleeding at the top of its lungs. Philip started lowering the screaming, squirming goat, then stopped short.
Martin, would you please go close the gate? If I put him down and the gate's still open, he'll just run back to the other pen.
Martin climbed over the fence, keeping an eye on the levitating goat. It was impressive just how constantly and loudly the goat could bleat. As he closed the gate and tied a slipknot in the rope that held the gate shut, he heard Philip laugh and the bleating getting louder. He turned and saw that the goat was gliding up behind him, a whirling tornado of hooves and teeth. Martin fled, and the flying murderous goat followed him seemingly against its will. Martin realized that Philip was using the goat to chase him around the pen. Martin yelled,
"Dude, not cool!"
as he vaulted the fence. Philip put the goat down as gently as he could, but it was difficult to do while laughing.
"I really don't appreciate being treated like that," Martin said.
"That's all right. I appreciate it more than enough for both of us."
Martin shook his head.
"I don't know, man. The goat didn't seem to like that."
"You wanted to go in and shove it by hand. Would that be more fun for the goat? Or for you, for that matter?"
Martin conceded the point. Philip went back to the hovel's front door and knocked. There was a distant, dismissive-sounding shout and some hissing. Philip yelled goodbye through the closed door, and soon they were back in the air.
"So what now?"
Martin yelled over the wind as they flew above the treetops. Philip yelled back.
"We're done with work for the day. Everyone saw us leave on important business. Miss Abigail can tell people that we levitated her goat, if anyone can understand her. The illusion has been maintained. If we weren't in training, we'd be free to take the rest of the day off."
"So we're going to start my training then?"
Martin asked, not bothering to hide his excitement.
"Yes,"
Philip said as he steered them to a landing in a clearing.
"Step one is to find you a staff."
They spent nearly an hour poking around the undergrowth looking for a fallen branch that was tall enough, thick enough, and straight enough. It was a pleasant way to spend a day, and they fell easily into conversation.
"Preferably you want it slightly thicker at the top, with a good place to mount some sort of mysterious object,"
Philip said as he poked through the underbrush with the end of his staff.
"Like that bottle of red stuff on yours? I was going to ask you what the deal was with that."
Philip held his staff by the end and extended it so that its top and the corked bottle were closer to Martin's face.
"When the locals ask me what it is, I tell them it's a vial of dragon's blood. Since you're asking, I'll admit that it's a salad dressing Cruet I bought in a department store. The red stuff is Tabasco sauce."
"Really?"
"Really. If they don't believe it's dragon's blood, I pull the cork and let them smell it. That usually convinces them. One time I got caught putting some on my dinner. I thought I was in trouble, but everyone just thought I ate dragon blood. So in the end, it helped sell the image."
They lapsed into silence for a while before Martin spoke again.
"What can you tell me about the trials?"
"Not much. Sorry. If I tell you what the trials entail, you'll only concentrate on those parts of the training, and it's never a good idea to teach to the test. All I can tell you is when you're ready, we will go see the chairman. There'll be a feast in your honor. All the wizards who can make it will attend. Then the next morning you will face the trials. If you pass, you'll be given full access to our shell program, and you'll be a wizard."
"And if I fail, I get sent back to my time without any access to the file."
"Yes. But focusing on failure just makes you more likely to fail. When you succeed, you'll have tremendous powers and the freedom to go anywhere and do almost anything you want."
"Almost anything?"
"Yes. As I said earlier, we sort of self-regulate. But there are certain things that are taboo. We'll cover all that later. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves."
Martin reached down into a bush and pulled up a likely-looking stick.
"How about this one?
Not straight enough."
Martin threw the stick back. "So, who's the chairman?" Martin thought Philip hadn't heard him and was about to repeat the question when Philip said,
Jimmy's his name, but the locals call him Merlin.
Martin was thunderstruck.
So there really is a Merlin?
No, there really isn't a Merlin. There really is a Jimmy who found the file 2 years after I did and turned up in this time less than a week after me. I got here and found that they already had the author, legend, and Merlin, so I just made a nice low-key life for myself in Ledchurch. Jimmy makes a beeline for London and becomes the court magician and advisor to King Stephen. Stephen had just lost Brittany to the Plantagenets, so he was willing to listen to suggestions. Eventually, Jimmy convinced him that the Arthur legend was actually a prophecy, and talked him into changing the name of his son, the heir apparent to Arthur. Since the kid's name was Eustace, he didn't argue. Then, to top it all off, Jimmy changed the name of London to Camelot.
He can't do that!
Martin shouted.
Well, don't tell him that when you meet him. He'll be very disappointed since he already did it 9 years ago.
But we can't just change the past like that.
Martin, we can't not change the past. In theory, everything we do has an effect, whether it's a small thing like talking to a tailor you meet on the road, or a big silly thing like introducing an innful of peasants to the marvels of cling film.
Martin blushed a bit.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't thinking.
I know. We talked about that.
Thankfully, you are thinking now. And I'm horrified. Yes, that's how I know you're thinking. So, Philip, how are we going to fix it?
Fix what? The timeline? The space-time continuum? Gnarly, unfillable plot holes?
Yes, all those things. Philip sat on a conveniently placed log.
They don't exist.
He indicated a spot on the log next to him.
Have a seat. This is pretty heavy stuff.
Martin sat beside him.
You knew time travel was possible, which means you tried it, which means you almost certainly met yourself.
Yes.
Thought you'd be taller, right?
Yes.
It's a cliche for a reason. I'm sure you figured out that cause always preceded effect from your point of view, so you couldn't really mess up your own future.
Yes. So that's how it is with the timeline, huh? We can't do anything that messes it up because we've already done everything, right?
There are two answers to that question. We don't know, and no, certainly not. There's still a lot we don't know about the file and how things work. Most wizards spend their spare time trying to figure things out, and it can be a full-time job if you let it be.
Most wizards?
Some of us have other projects.
Is that what you have upstairs in your shop? A project?
I told you there's nothing up there! Don't change the subject. Anyway, when I came back here, I was extremely careful. I knew my actions didn't seem to make any difference to the timeline, but I didn't want to take any chances. Then Jimmy shows up and starts changing huge things willy-nilly.
What happened?
Aside from Jimmy and me having a huge argument, nothing. Martin, nothing we do seems to affect the future at all. In the last 10 years, the entire country is called London Camelot. All of the official dispatches, all of the ledgers, all say Camelot. Yet if you go back to your time, you'll find Camelot still a myth, and London still London.
How's that possible?
We just don't know. Some think that something happens later that erases all of this from history and puts things right. Whatever it is in the future, it's already happened, so we see the fixed reality. But back here, it hasn't happened yet, so we're free to muck about all we want.
That's a good explanation.
But it's not true, and I'll tell you why. Predetermination. If that explanation is true, it means that everything we do is set in stone hundreds of years before we were born. It means we're not individuals, just robots running through pre-programmed responses. And I can't accept that.
But the whole reason we're here is that we've proved that we're algorithms in a computer program.
That may be, but I'm an algorithm with free will. Anytime someone claims I don't have free will, I shout, "Shut up!" at the top of my lungs, because it's totally out of character for me, and it proves I have free will.
Martin thought about this for a moment. You shout, "Shut up," every time?
Yes.
That proves nothing. If you do it every time, then yelling, "Shut up," is a pre-programmed response. Philip thought about that for a moment, then replied,
"Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!"
Martin smiled while Philip caught his breath.
Got it out of your system?
For now. So that's one explanation, which I don't buy. The other explanation is that when we go back in time past a certain point, the program, whatever it is, creates a parallel instance of the past for us to go to.
So this is an alternate reality?
I think so.
Wouldn't we be able to go to the future, then?
Not beyond our own source time. The idea has its problems, and there's a lot we don't know, but it does explain why we all seem to go to a few specific points in history. The program already has this place set up, so it sort of influences us to come here instead of some other place.
But doesn't that suggest that we don't have free will?
Philip gave Martin an icy stare. Martin put up his hand.
Sorry, I'll shut up.
Philip stood up and stretched.
Ah, top man. In retrospect, a certain amount of chronological pollution was inevitable, really. I first noticed it when one of the locals told me the weather sucked. I didn't even notice it at first. Then I freaked right out for a while.
But just for a while?
Yeah, well, it didn't seem to hurt anything. Quite the opposite. As I told you, there are wizards like us living in Baghdad in the 700s. Well, when you look around you, this all looks as you expected medieval England to look, but I can tell you that we aren't supposed to have glass windows until centuries later. Yet, here they are, and I'm mighty glad of it.
But don't you see how wrong that is? Martin said. You've made the past...
Martin couldn't find the word he wanted. He eventually settled on
inauthentic.
I'm not going to pretend you don't have a point, Martin. But like I said, a certain amount of chronological pollution was inevitable. We try not to deliberately change the past, most of us at least. When there is a change we can't smooth over, it's not really the end of the world, because while we may have irrevocably changed this time, the fact is that it's had no effect whatsoever on the future.
Martin shook his head.
I still don't buy the idea that we aren't changing the future.
If you don't believe me, look for yourself. You've got that fancy pocket computer of yours? Pop back to your time and see if anything has changed.
Walter and Margarita Banks watched as their son rooted frantically through the kitchen before finding a package of cling film. Margarita asked him what was going on. Instead of answering, he asked,
Do you have any heavy duty? This stuff's a little flimsy.
In the cupboard under the sink, she replied. Why are you wearing your Snape costume?
Martin muttered,
It's Malfoy. You always get that wrong.
But his parents did not hear him, partly because of the sound of many sirens coming from the front lawn. Martin grabbed two boxes of heavy duty cling film and sprinted back to his room, shouting, Thanks, Mom! As he slammed the door. Walter and Margarita looked down the hallway at their son's bedroom door. They turned their heads when they heard an insistent knock on the front door. They turned their heads again when Martin opened his bedroom door. He peeked his head out into the hall, looked at them, and said,
Hi, just checking. What's the capital of England?
Margarita answered,
London?
Martin retreated into the room again, slamming the door shut behind him. Martin quickly scanned his childhood belongings. There were Star Wars toys, a few Power Rangers, nothing all that impressive. The one thing that stood out was a small painted plaster bust he had bought when he was 12, and his family went to Mexico to visit his mom's relatives. Martin rematerialized in the meadow.
Everything the way you left it?
Philip asked.
Yes, and I found what I'm going to put on the head of my staff!
Martin proudly held aloft the small painted plaster bust of El Santo, King of the Luchadores.